Translation: are you describing as formless that supreme personality of Godhead, whose transcendental form is complete with six transcendental opulences? Purple by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. If the supreme personality of Godhead is formless, how can he be said to walk very fast and accept everything offered to him, rejecting the direct meaning of the Vedic mantras? The Mayavadi philosophers interpret them and try to establish the absolute truth as formless. Actually, the Supreme Lord has an eternal personal form full of all opulence. The Mayavadi philosophers try to interpret the absolute truth as being without potency. However, in the Svetasvasara Upanishad 6.8, it is clearly said, Parashasya Shaktir Vidhaiva Shruyate, the absolute truth has multi-potencies. Translation again: are you describing as formless that supreme personality of Godhead, whose transcendental form is complete with six transcendental opulences? Om Ajanat Marandasya Dhananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Umlitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swaya Rupa Gadamayam Dadati Swabhadantikam. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shivasadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hari Hari, Hari Rama, Hari Rama, Rama Rama, Hari Hari. Okay, so let me speak a little. I'll speak a little on the verse and then also a little on Shivas Thakur, Shivas Pandit's appearance day. But, you know, when reading this verse and purport, it's kind of amazing that it's everything about what the Hare Krishna movement and what Srila Prabhupada came to the West to offer to people, explain to people, and give the correct understanding to people. Because this verse, are you describing as formless? And then Prabhupada saying in the purport that the Mayavad philosophers interpret them and try to establish the absolute truth as formless. And of course we know in Srila Prabhupada's Pranam mantras that he came to, you know, banish the world, if you like, from impersonalism and voidism. And this desire to make somebody formless or to present that the Supreme is formless is just so very, very convenient. Because by doing so, you ultimately or effectively have no responsibility, because there is no one you're responsible to, because the person is formless. There is no person. They're completely formless like that. And that, of course, leads to so many negatives. And the one that immediately springs to mind, as Prabhupada talks about on many occasions, is the nihilistic mentality that flows from that acceptance and presentation of the Supreme Person not being a person, being formless, being impersonal. And nihilism literally means that, you know, that nothing is real. Everything is false. There are no rules. There's no order, and it leads to chaos and anarchy and all of those kind of things. And of course, in the history of the world, you know, away from the transcendental presentation that Srila Prabhupada gives us, you know, you still have today's Easter Sunday, and there's many, many millions of people, if not, you know, hundreds of millions of people around the globe who'll be celebrating that and celebrating Jesus rising from the dead, etc. So that isn't a impersonal view at all. In fact, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his pre-life, if you like,
said he had more of an affinity with the Christian tradition than he did with the tradition of impersonalism, the tradition that he was exposed to in India at that time, because it was a personal philosophy. So in the history of the world, it's not all one, that everybody has that impersonal view, and it's always been a battle between the two, that atheistic view, that impersonal view like that, that nihilistic view. And then those who had faith that there is a supreme person like that. Of course, in the absence of, and Prabhupada told us many times that we have to get this balance between philosophy and sentiment, you know, the religious sentiment and then the philosophical underpinning of that religious sentiment. Because without that philosophical underpinning of that religious sentiment, it's very hard for the religionists to defeat the atheists. And the atheists will come up with so many reasons and so-called, you know, intelligent, logical reasons as to why there's no such thing as God like that. So even, and it's kind of an interesting little, and we are, ironically, as I said, this is Easter Sunday, and this is also the appearance day of Srivast Thakur, that you can see that, you know, it's so useful. Obviously, for devotees, obviously we know it's completely useful, not just useful, but it's the absolute truth. But even for those from another religious tradition, it's so useful to have people like Srila Prabhupada and, of course, all the great philosophers, etc., of the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. Because just by definition, we're better equipped to defeat those atheistic arguments like that. So it's even an interfaith argument, if you like, that, you know, we can be very, very useful to the other religious traditions for them to have more faith and confidence, if you like, in their own tradition. So our Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition is strongly critical of Mayavad philosophy. And that philosophy is the theory that all variety and all individuality are illusion, as well as the Advaitavad, the theory that the only truth is impersonal and what they refer to as undifferentiated oneness, like that. So both Vadas, if you like, Mayavad, Advaitavad, etc., the Gaudiya Vaishnava is strongly critical of it. And you saw with Srila Prabhupada, if there were two subjects that really, really energized him. Not that he needed energizing, he was super energetic, positive, and all of those things. But if there was two subjects that you really saw him get even extra energy, extra animation, it was in challenging the Mayavad philosophy and also the atheistic scientific philosophy that would be presented, not necessarily by Mayavads per se, but just by atheistic scientists. So yeah, so that's our mission, if you like, following in Srila Prabhupada's footsteps, to defeat the Mayavad philosophy like that. We do not say, you see in the purport there, close the book here, let me get it quickly. They were trying to establish the absolute truth as formless. And Prabhupada goes on to say that the Supreme Lord has an eternal personal form full of opulence. Like that. So we don't. Then he quotes the Vaisashvachara Upanishad saying that the absolute truth has multipotencies. So it's not that we as devotees say that God does not have an impersonal feature. We do say that God has an impersonal feature. Our position simply is that that impersonal feature is not the ultimate or not the ultimate reality. Bhagavad Gita tells us in the 12th chapter, 12.5, Tesho Dikar Talastesham, that Mayavad and Advaitavad, they're very difficult paths, if not impossible paths to follow in order to make spiritual progress on. And, you know, numerous points, so many points can be made against the case for Mayavad and Advaitavad philosophy. You know, one being that according to their theories or those theories of impersonalism and voidism, etc., the ultimate reality, as I said, is pure. Their ultimate reality is pure undifferentiated oneness with all variety and individuality being products of illusion. Everything is illusion like that. However, you know, if we accept that view that everything is illusion, then, you know, any reasonably logical kind of brain would then ask, well, where does the illusion come from? And now a thought has popped in my mind, and I'll try to hold it and go back to that. But that's a logical question to ask. Where does the illusion come from? And, you know, this is a question through millennia that the Mayavadis, etc., they've so far failed to answer. And given that they failed to answer that question, we could be forgiven for concluding that they probably don't have an answer. You know, people are asked a question multiple times, and they don't offer you or give you an answer, then I think it's fair to conclude that, well, maybe they don't have an answer. Anyways, so if only oneness exists, then illusion cannot also exist. Because then you would have two-ness, you would have duality. If they're saying only illusion exists, if only oneness exists, then how can you how can illusion simultaneously exist? Because then it's no longer oneness, it's two-ness. It's not oneness anymore, because two things are existing. And if you say that two-ness only seems to exist, that its existence is an illusion, or but an illusion, then you're basically back to where we started, and we're just going around in this kind of circular argument all the time. And that's essentially what has been happening for it since time immemorial, pretty much. So quite some time ago, and it always stuck in my mind quite some time ago, I read a scientific paper. And the scientific paper, it wasn't just by one individual, it was by a kind of conglomerate of eminent scientists, all of the atheistic view, which, by the way, is as I understand it, the predominant view in the scientific world, but it's not the only view. There are actually theists also in the scientific world. But anyway, this paper, written by a group of them, eminent scientists, and it was an atheistic view, but the whole paper was about the existence of the universe, how it came into existence. And there were a couple of sentences that stuck in my mind, and they basically were saying that on that specific question, how did creation come about? Their answer was that the entire creation that we see, and of course that's incredibly limited in and of itself, but anyway, the entire creation that we see or that they're aware of, that came from the Big Bang. Their key phrase was, that it popped into existence out of nothing or from nothing. It just popped into existence from nothing. Which, given this paper, which was, you know, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was over 100 pages in total. So it was a very, you know, in-depth paper. It's an extraordinary, that's the essence. It's a little bit like, you know, the Chatter-Shloki, you know, our Chatter-Shloki, if you like, because these couple of sentences were their conclusion, their Chatter-Shloki. It's kind of amazing that that's the language they use, popped into existence out of nothing. It's kind of like something a 10-year-old would come up with. So then they go on, the second part, which is even more interesting, was, so creation had to come about, the universe that we see, the universes that we see had to come about, they had to happen, because in their view, nothing is inherently unstable. Now, I stop there. That's their quote. Nothing is inherently unstable. This is my comment. I don't know about you, but I never knew that until I read that paper, that nothing is inherently unstable. For me, nothing means nothing. It's nothing, and that's it. End of story. But their conclusion was, nothing is inherently unstable, and therefore something had to come from the nothingness. And what came from the nothingness was everything that we see when you look out on a moonless, clear night, and you see all these stars and all these planets, etc., like that. Now, that is so much like what's happening in this verse today, when you have them claiming that everything is illusion. It's just so convenient. Also, in the case of the scientists, it's also good for their ego, because they're presenting a conclusive, from their perspective, a conclusive truth as to how the universe came into existence. And what's really good is the answer that the Mayavadis don't give about where did illusion come from. So the obvious question to the scientists is, okay, Because part of the paper they're not arguing against, they're presenting the same point that you've probably heard, we've all heard from our school days, I guess, that the origin of the universe actually started when gases came together, and then the gases interacted and they weren't compatible or whatever, and because of that a big explosion, what's known as the Big Bang, took place. So the obvious question to the scientist is, okay, so where did the gases come from? Where did they come from? And, you know, I've never heard, maybe there is an answer out there, but I've never heard the answer to that question, just as the answer to the question given to the Mayavadis, where did illusion come from? You know, they don't have an answer to that question. So in the same way, where did the gases come from? Now, even if you accept that they just happened to be there, they came out of nothing, because nothing is inherently unstable. So they came out of nothing. But even if we accept that premise, then you have the explosion, the Big Bang. And then from the Big Bang, we're told that, you know, it created some kind of primordial soup, you know, some kind of lakes of liquid and whatever, and that was the breeding ground then for life. And then they say there were, you know, single cell amoebas or whatever. And, you know, eventually they interacted and this and that. And eventually things started crawling out of this primordial soup in the form of reptiles, I think, you know, and the reptiles turn into birds, etc. And then it's the whole evolutionary theory, and everything evolved from that point on. But that in itself is so interesting, because we still have those single-cell amoebas and single-cell atoms and whatever. We still have. They still exist. You know, scientists have them, you know, in laboratories all the time, etc. So we still have those. We still have the reptiles that supposedly generated from those single cells, etc. We still have the birds flying in the skies, etc. And then, of course, you know, the fish. I think it's the cell that they were the first kind of life, and then somehow or other the fish into the reptiles, etc. Reptiles into birds, birds into animals, animals into humans. So we now have the full chain. Right from the very beginning, those single cell entities, right up to human beings like that. We have the whole chain now in place. So when you ask them, well, where is this, you know, half ape, half human creature? And of course, you know, as a kid growing up, I remember watching films about the Yeti and the Abominable Snowman, etc. In Canada, I think they called it the Sasquatch. You know, so you have these different theories of this creature that literally is the half ape, half man, you know, evolving into man. So when you ask them, well, we have the single cells, we have the humans, so, and we have everything in between. Please show us this creature that's the hybrid between ape and human. Then what do they say to you? They say, ah, that's the missing link. That is the missing link. Again, such a convenient answer. And kind of the most disappointing thing when they give that answer is that so many people, you can just imagine an audience of, say, 500 people in some, you know, posh auditorium somewhere, and there's this whole scientific presentation being made by these eminent scientists, and they make that point, ah, that's the missing link. You can just imagine all the people in that 500-seat auditorium or whatever it is. You can just see them in your mind's eye. You can see them all sort of, you know, nodding their heads in approval, maybe looking at each other and go, ah, the missing link, ah, the missing link. Such a disappointing reaction that nobody really puts these people under pressure, you know, and you know, challenges their threadbare answers. Actually, it's a classic case of you know, having your cake and eating it like that. So Srila Prabhupada, and of course in the footsteps of Lord Chaitanya, he taught that the doctrine that while everything is one with the absolute truth, it's simultaneously inconceivable and different from the absolute truth as well. The philosophy of Achintabheda Bheda Tattva, which was something, of course, that actually Srila Prabhupada's spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, really, really elaborated on in great detail. And that's, again, like the purport that we're reading today, or the verse and purport that we're reading today. Yes, of course. the absolute truth contains everything. So there is an impersonal feature to the absolute truth, but it's not the complete picture. And this Achinta Beta Beta Tattva philosophy, just as sunshine is both one with and different from the sun, the personality of Godhead simultaneously is the same like that, has an impersonal feature, has a personal feature, and everything in between. So within the personality of Godhead, everything that is seemingly irreconcilable can be easily reconciled. And the person, I think the reference from the Svetashvatara Upanishad was had multipotencies, and that's true. The personality of Godhead, the Supreme Reality, has countless energies, and they're all real. They're all real. And also as real is the energy that places us under illusion when illusion is what we desire. It's not forced on us, but like all these atheistic scientists, etc., you know, if they want illusion, they get illusion. That's the thing. Krishna fulfills all desires. It's just such an amazing philosophy. Our philosophy is just so amazing and has the answers to all the questions. So if we want illusion, then we'll get illusion. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells us, Devi Esha Gunamayi, that although this illusion energy is nearly insurmountable, so it's there, and it's nearly insurmountable. However, if we surrender to Krishna, then at once we can cross beyond that illusion. And why wouldn't we be able to? Because once we surrender to Krishna, if Krishna is the source of that illusion, then naturally, you know, it's so easy to overcome. So therefore, the Hare Krishna movement, ISKCON, Srila Prabhupada's movement, is strongly promoting surrender to Krishna in preference to all other speculative philosophies. And this goes back, you know, as I said, it's time immemorial in that sense, but just to reflect on this particular point, that as Lord Buddha, Krishna, he rejected the Vedas. The Vedas were rejected. Can you imagine, you know, rejecting the Vedas and taught what was in essence an atheistic philosophy? Of course, he did that to stop what was the needless animal slaughter being conducted and indulged in, using the excuse of Vedic rituals to do that. But then later on the order of Lord Vishnu, Lord Shiva, he appeared as Sankaracharya and defeated Buddhism and then reasserted the authority of the Vedas. But in order to do that, to reassert the authority of the Vedas, he taught a compromise philosophy that ultimately was another kind of covered form of Buddhism. So even though great personalities, these doctrines were taught by great personalities, the doctrines of voidism and impersonalism, and by the way, the very fact that that's there, you know, great personalities like Sankaracharya, Lord Buddha, that they were teaching, essentially teaching these philosophies, you can also see why they're so deep-rooted in so many people's minds, in so many people's hearts, etc. Oops, I meant to put my phone on silent. Just bear with me one second. My apologies for that. You can see why these philosophies and these understandings become so deep-rooted, because they have been taught by these incredibly powerful personalities, incarnations of the Supreme Person. But ultimately, even though they taught them, they're what you might call temporary contrivances. They're not the conclusive truth. And this is the whole picture then, that yes, you know, Lord Buddha came and Sankaracharya came after Lord Buddha. But then, of course, after Sankaracharya came Lord Chaitanya. And if we want the true Vedic conclusion, we should turn to the Srimad Bhagavatam as taught by Lord Chaitanya and his followers, which is now being represented by our humble selves in the following in the footsteps of Srila Prabhupada. And of course, you know, it's really also important for us to understand then the importance of the distribution of Srila Prabhupada's books and the distribution of his literature. It is so important because it contains, it doesn't just, it's not dogmatic, just of course, Prabhupada, I was going to say, it's not dogmatic and just trashing these philosophies. In one sense, you could argue it is, you know, on some levels, but it gives all such detailed explanations of why these philosophies are bogus, or at least why they're not the full picture, the complete picture. And therefore, you know, the more that we get this literature out, and once it's out there, you know, the more impact then it can have in the lives of the people who are basically, you know, trapped, if you like, in thinking that these philosophies are the all in all. Anyway, for a more detailed analysis of all of that, you know, we can go to the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the Adi Lila, chapter 7, which gives a really detailed explanation of all of that. And just to finish on before I move on to talking a little bit about Shivas Thakur, just to finish on that point about, because we mentioned today is Easter Sunday, I was just going to make that reference to Jesus Christ where he said, blissful are those who believe without seeing. And that's in direct opposition to the kind of material concept of seeing is believing. So, you know, that's another thing for us. This is more an internal point, actually, rather than a preaching point or something that you would necessarily say to people who are not devotees. But, you know, an internal point is that we, while we may not have completed our journey on the path back to Godhead, while we still have some steps to take in that regard, we should, at this stage of our devotional lives, at least be convinced of the fact that we are on the right path. Our position now really is no longer really to question or necessarily to have doubts, really. Of course, doubts are a good thing in spiritual life that, you know, you can learn from them, etc., and you can get your questions explained. But the point I'm just trying to make is that, you know, now that we've come in contact with ISKCON, with Srila Prabhupada's devotees, Srila Prabhupada's books, most importantly of all, etc., and of course we know about the life story of Srila Prabhupada, really the point about are we on the right path? It's no longer really a question that we need to ask, you know. So in that quote from Jesus that, you know, blessed are those who believe without seeing. Of course, we have seen. It's not that we didn't see anything. But, you know, we should have firm faith and complete confidence in the shelter of Srila Prabhupada and the path that we're on like that. Just wanted to make that point. We don't have to worry about that anymore. That's not a worry we have to have. The only worry, for want of a better word, is that, you know, our own practice and our own identification and our own strength and conviction in relation to pursuing that path in its totality like that. That's what we need to focus on now, as opposed to worrying whether we're on the right path or not. Okay, so today is the appearance day of Shivas Thakur, Shivas Pandit. And as we know, Shivas is one of what's known as the five principles or the five truths, which is better known as the Panchatattva. And in our Gaudiya Vaishnava theology, there are five conscious elements. There's the primal God, then there's his first expansion of God governing spirituality or spirit, the second expansion of God, which is governing the material manifestation. Then there's God's spiritual Shakti, the feminine counterpart of God. And then finally, there's the Jiva, the category that we all fall into. And those five conscious elements, they're manifested in the spiritual world, in the spiritual realm, as Lord Krishna, Lord Balaram, Mahavishnu, Srimati Radharani, and then perfected souls like Narada Muni. And here in the material world, or the material realm, the most recent manifestation of those five principles, those five truths, appearing as devotees were Sri Krishna appeared as Lord Chaitanya, Lord Balaram appeared as Lord Nityananda, Mahavishnu appeared as Sri Advaita Acharya, Srimati Radharani appeared as Gadadhar Pandit, and Narada Muni as Shivas Pandit. And Shivas is representing the pure jivas who dedicate their lives to serving the Lord. Serving the Lord in the mood of, because to distinguish from us, we're also serving the Lord, and we've also dedicated our lives and are continuing that process of dedicating our lives. So just just to make the distinction that those pure jivas, of which we obviously are aspiring to be, dedicate their lives in the service of Krishna in the mood of ahoitakiya pratihata. So it's both unmotivated, there is no motivation for serving Krishna. It's done completely selflessly. And there's no interruption. And boy, if we can achieve those two qualities, that our devotional service is never interrupted. Prabhupada used to talk about, serving Krishna even while we're sleeping. And of course, as devotees, as well as serving Krishna when we're sleeping, we also try not to sleep too much. So we have many, many waking hours for serving Krishna. So without any interruption, and then simultaneously, that service is done in a complete mood of selflessness. Then yes, we've achieved perfection essentially. So that's Srivas's mood, and he's representing those pure jivas. And that's kind of the goal, for want of a better word, like that. And that's Srivas's position. So he's representing that marginal energy of the living entity, the Tathasta jiva. And the devotees that are headed by Srivas Thakur, they're described as Lord Chaitanya's smaller limbs, but they're all taking part in Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. And actually, in that context, and Prabhupada talks about it in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, that ISKCON is one of the branches of Lord Chaitanya. It's Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement, like that. So we're all taking part directly in Lord Chaitanya's pastimes. And the taking part will be ever increasing and ever effective. And for us internally, deeper and deeper realizations will develop the more that we adopt this mood of Srivas of Ahoitakiya Pratihata. And Srivas is described as being one of the most important personalities who helped or assisted Lord Chaitanya in his pastimes. And he graced the Astami Titi in the month of Chaitra, which is today. And he appeared on this very day in this world for the benefit of all conditioned souls, because without his mercy, without Srivas's mercy, the holy names, the Sankirtan movement, effectively would not have spread out into the wider world, because it was in Srivas Thakur, Srivas Pandit's house, where Lord Chaitanya began his Sankirtan movement. Can you imagine, you know, that the Lord, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, starts this whole incredible movement that is predicted in Shastra for, you know, time immemorial, and it is started in your house. So this was the role of Srivas Pandit. The Sankirtan movement started in his house. And every single night for a year, Lord Chaitanya, he would gather with his companions, his most intimate companions, in Srivas's courtyard, and it was all done behind closed doors. And they would just chant the holy name and experience the highest spiritual ecstasy. And the whole thing was so... so special, so unique, so extraordinary. These pastimes were just unparalleled pastimes. And so much so that at one point, Lord Chaitanya, he revealed to Srivas and the other very intimate devotees that were in that circle, he revealed that he was actually the Supreme Lord. As we know, Lord Chaitanya came in the mood of a devotee and you know, resisted, if you like, at all times, pretty much manifesting himself as the Supreme Person, you know, and always wanted to be in the mood of a devotee. But he did, in this wonderful Leela known as the Mahaprakash Leela, he revealed to Srivas Thakur and his intimate associates that he was the Supreme Lord. And then it's described for 21 hours non-stop, Srivas and his associates, they blissfully performed worship of the Lord along with kirtan, while they're all chanting kirtan. And the Lord sat, because we never see this, you know, Lord Chaitanya, he sat on a shingasan, actually on the deity altar in Shivas Thakur's house or courtyard. As I said, you know, prior to that, and even subsequent to that, Lord Chaitanya was really exclusively focusing on his role as a devotee. So it just makes this pastime, Mahaprakash Leela, so quite incredible. Quite incredible. And you can go there. I've been there. I'm sure many of you listening have been there. You can go to Srivas Thakur's Srivas Angam. You can actually go there and see the place where this where all this happened and all this took place like that. You can go. So it's quite amazing. Because oftentimes, like with Krishna's pastimes, it's kind of much more difficult to get that. I mean, there are places that you can go, but, you know, it was so long ago, particularly in terms of quote-unquote physical evidence of buildings, etc., they no longer really exist. There are one or two exceptions, but generally, you know, it's kind of hard to, and therefore it's harder for us to, in one sense, to enter into the mood of everything. But when you can actually physically go to a place that only 530 years ago, or whatever it was, Lord Chaitanya was physically there, you can really imbibe the mood. So yeah, Srivas Thakur was an incarnation of Narada Muni. And through Srivas, Lord Chaitanya taught us how he, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, can be conquered by the love of his devotee. And there were different examples of that in the pastimes between Lord Chaitanya and Srivas, how Lord Chaitanya's heart was completely conquered by Srivas. One example was when Lord Chaitanya was very young, you know, and at that point he was known as Nimai Pandit, not least because he defeated Keshava Kashmiri in that great philosophical debate just as a boy. So one time, as Nimai Pandit, you know, and maybe actually was this directly related to the defeat of Keshava Kashmiri? It may well have been. But anyway, due to, you know, Nimai's scholarship and learning, etc., he'd become, you know, a little bit puffed up. And Srivas Thakur, one time, he directly challenged Nimai on this and said, you know, why do people study? People study so they might understand what is actually devotion to Lord Sri Krishna. However, if by scholarship and learning one doesn't gain that devotion to Lord Krishna, to Sri Krishna, then how will that learning help them? Rather than helping them, it becomes a burden. It becomes a tedious endeavor, you know, which in the end is ultimately a waste of time because you haven't achieved the goal that's the whole point of the Vedas. We can study the Vedas, but the whole point of the Vedas is to understand that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So if that isn't what we conclude, then ultimately our learning and our scholarship has been a waste of time. So if you've actually learned something, and the challenge to Nimai Pandit, if you've actually learned something, then you should begin your worship of Lord Krishna right now. This is the purpose of your life. To which, of course, Nimai, he laughed, and he said to Srivas, well, you know, it will be by your mercy that will come to pass. And if you're kind enough to me, then I'll definitely attain devotion to Lord Krishna's lotus feet. So this was, Lord Chaitanya giving that instruction in the context of it's only by the mercy of devotees. And that goes back a little bit to the quote of Jesus about seeing is believing. At some point, you know, we have to accept, that's the wrong way of putting it really, but at some point we will get to a stage where we understand that everything ultimately is the mercy of Krishna and the mercy of his devotees, and that's how we make progress in spiritual life. That's the real key. That's the real key to unlock that final door, if you like, you know, into the inner chamber, the inner sanctum of spiritual realization and spiritual rasa and spiritual relationship that ultimately only comes from the mercy of Krishna, and even arguably more importantly, from the mercy of the devotees. And shortly after that exchange with Srivas Pandit, Lord Chaitanya, he travelled to Gaya, where he accepted initiation from his spiritual master, Ishvara Puri, and he did that to show and to illustrate that point that he had just made to Srivas, that it will be by your mercy that I'll understand Krishna and attain Krishna's lotus feet. So then he took initiation, and he did it to show that without the blessings of great souls, without the prayers of great devotees, basically petitioning Krishna to shower us with mercy, that there is little hope that we ever will without that mercy and that goodwill, that support from pure devotees and from advanced devotees, from devotees in general, even like that. And much later then, that same mercy, that very mercy, was bestowed on Srivas himself by Lord Chaitanya, during one of those ecstatic kirtans in his house. And this pastime, I'm sure you're familiar with it, but, quite amazing that one night while Lord Chaitanya was in Srivas's home and they were having these ecstatic kirtans, Srivas's own son developed a fever, or had a fever, developed a fever, and left his body while this was all taking place. When Srivas became aware of that, he went into his son's room to find that it was true that he was dead. And he told those present, family members and friends, and his wife, etc. And he told those to stop crying. They were crying, which is perfectly natural emotion, and they were crying. He told them that there should be no grief, as even a most sinful person, if they die hearing the holy name, they're immediately liberated. Which when I read these pastimes, I'm always thinking that, how wonderful to be able to leave this world hearing the holy name. What greater benediction can you get, really, in many ways? So anyway, Srivas Thakura's son, excuse me for one second, Srivas Thakura's son, left his body, but he left his body while in this incredible situation of being at Srivas Angam with Lord Chaitanya and all these intimate devotees blissfully chanting the holy names. So Srivas said, there's no need to grieve, as even the most sinful person, if they die hearing the holy names, they're liberated. And he went on to explain that his son is just so fortunate that he's left his body hearing the holy name. And not only just hearing the holy name, but hearing the holy name from the lips of Lord Chaitanya and his dearmost devotees. We use that phrase, dearmost, but, we can rest assured that those who participated in the beginning, the birth of this Sankirtan movement, Harinam Sankirtan, in that intimate association, they were really, really special devotees. They were the Lord's dearmost devotees. So this is how his son left his body, hearing them all chanting the holy name. And he just explained to his wife and family members that his son is just so fortunate. He's back now in the spiritual world. Of course, hearing the holy names, I'm sure Srivas Angam is the spiritual world too. But you know what I mean? He's back in this, or what Srivas said, he's back in the spiritual world. So if you want to cry, if you're needing to cry, if you wish to cry, just do it silently in your own heart. But don't tell anyone what's happened, because I don't want to disturb this chanting. I don't want Lord Chaitanya to know about what's happened in case it disturbs the situation. And he even said, something I can relate to in terms of these dramatic kind of points that are made. But he says, if they get disturbed, I will simply tie a pot around my neck and I will drown myself in the Ganges, in the Ganga, like that. So then Srivas, after, explaining that to the family members and hopefully pacifying them to some degree, he went back into the kirtan. And with a big smile. So his son has just passed away. As you can see, I'm wearing white. And I have two sons myself. Because sometimes I do want them to die. Actually, not anymore. Maybe when they were younger and causing me so much grief. They didn't really, actually. They were pretty good kids. But anyway, as a grihastha, if you have children, and they say one of the most unnatural things in life is that if your children die before you, because it's not following, if you like, the natural order, because parents, by definition, will be 20, 30 years older than their children. So the logical kind of course is that parents will die before their children. That's like the kind of natural order, if you like. But of course, sometimes the children do die first. But it's understood that that's a very painful experience, which I haven't experienced, but which is a very painful experience. And I can well imagine that being the case, because it's just so natural that there's attachment there to family members. But Srivas Thakur, he went back into the kirtan and, you know, just started dancing with Lord Chaitanya in ecstasy with you know, a big smile on his face and all of that kind of thing. And the kirtan, you know, continued throughout the whole night. But eventually Lord Chaitanya did, become aware of the death of Srivas's son. And Lord Chaitanya himself then cried tears of love. Not so much for Srivas's son, although maybe something was there also, but it was just because of the devotion, the pure devotion of Srivas. And Lord Chaitanya made a statement that he would never be able to leave the association of Srivas because of this incredible Ahuitakiya Pratihata, pure devotion that Srivas was displaying and that was manifested. And he said that Srivas loves him so much that he does not even express any grief at the death of his own son. So yeah, all these incredible pastimes. Maybe, what time are we at now? We're 8:25. I don't know if anyone has any questions. Maybe if there are, someone can send me a message on screen. But otherwise, I'll continue. And I will mention this pastime, which is also, you know, because this pastime now gives us a little insight into the trials and tribulations that we all face in our lives, but specifically trials and tribulations that we will experience as devotees, and in particular, you know, the more that we advance in Krishna consciousness, and particularly the more that we're trying to preach Krishna consciousness, just as we were talking at the beginning, you know, the impersonalism and voidism that's in the world and the atheistic scientific presentations. And we have examples of this, I'm sure, in our own lives. Certainly we can give examples in Prabhupada's life and in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's life. But this is an example from Srivas Thakur's own life, that, you know, they would lock the doors of his house, and all these intimate kirtans, etc., would take place behind closed doors. And, you know, as we know in life now, I guess, sometimes people become annoyed by that. You know, particularly people that you might know, if you do, you know, if you have some event in your house, I'm sure you'll experience this or whatever, and it's, for whatever reason, the numbers have to be limited, so some people, by definition, get excluded, and some people, you know, they can get upset by that. So this was the same for Srivas Thakur, you know, so the doors would be locked, and some people would be excluded, and not necessarily devotees, but they would become angry and upset, and In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it actually describes that this pastime and that being excluded, some of those, and some of them were actually, as I said, they weren't devotees, they were non-devotees, described as pasandis, and they really became envious of this, and it's described how their envy was like a fire, and they were burning with envy. And of course, envy, one of the most corrosive of all anartas, by the way, such a powerful anarta that we really should do everything in our power to avoid being affected by and getting sucked in by like that. But anyway, one of the things that envy does is it's the brain starts ticking for revenge and plotting to see how you can get your own back on the person that you're envious of like that. So one of these main pasandis or non-believers was a Brahmin named Gopal Chapala. And what he decided to do in getting his own back and plotting against Srivas was he assembled all the paraphernalia for worship of Bhavani or Durga, which is very, very popular, by the way, in West Bengal. Sometimes I've been traveling back from Mayapur, or maybe traveling to or traveling back, either way, from Mayapur to Calcutta, from Calcutta to Mayapur, during Durga Puja, and boy, you know, some of the stuff that goes on at some of those events is you're only passing by and looking out the taxi door out the window, you know, seeing it, but it's quite scary, you know, quite heavy stuff. So anyway, he assembled all this paraphernalia, and he placed it outside Srivas Thakur's door. with an attempt to defame him like that. It's described actually that one of the reasons being that it's considered that worshippers of Durga or Kali, they're considered lower class, they drink wine and they eat meat, and obviously for a Vaishnava, for a devotee, such things, such activities are repugnant like that. So Gopal Chapala, he wanted to do this, he wanted to defame Srivas, and alongside that paraphernalia, he also placed a big pot of wine. And then in the morning when Srivas opened his door and he saw all the paraphernalia that Gopal had left there, his reaction was interesting. And it's also good for us as devotees that, you know, sometimes we may be put in a situation where, you know, on the face of it, we're compromised. But if we know in our hearts and our mind that we're not compromised, that, you know, in this case, Srivas was being set up like that, then we don't have to have any worry about that ultimately, because the reality is something different. So Srivas was like that, and he very bold, if you like, in his response. And so when he saw all that, he just called for all the respectable personalities of the neighborhood to gather. And then he said, and he showed them what was outside his door, and he said, you know, just see, you know, here's the paraphernalia for the worship of Durga. Every night I worship the goddess Durga. So now all you respectable personalities, you can understand my actual position, who I really am, and you can take whatever action you deem fit. So basically he had no concern or no worry, because he knew this wasn't true. And then because of that response, etc., those respectable personalities, they could immediately understand what had actually happened. That someone envious or someone's envious, you know, had wanted to do this and, you know, defame Srivas and desecrate him, desecrate his house, etc. Anyway, their reaction was they would just call for cleaner to dispose of all those untouchable things. I think it's described that the use of cow dung to purify. I always laugh when I think of cow dung. I remember one devotee. I won't mention names or places, but you know, they were opening a restaurant, a Govinda's restaurant. And the day before they opened, a couple of days before they opened, they decided one final thing they would do is they would just, you know, get a mix of water and cow dung and mix it together, hot water, cow dung, like that, and just do one kind of final sort of purification of the whole place, and that's what they did. And then I think the very day they opened, or maybe the next day, but very, very shortly after they opened the restaurant, they got an inspection from the health inspector, and they were just going through a checklist that they'd done all they should do to, you know, to have their certificate to open, that kind of thing. And the point came up about cleanliness, and, you know, the health inspectors, as is their job, I guess, you know, we're really focusing on that point about being clean, properly clean. And one devotee then piped up and said, oh, we're more than clean, because the day before we opened, after it was already perfectly clean, we then, you know, cleaned it again, but this time with a combination of water and cow dung, because that's purifying. And I was stuck to her, and he closed the restaurant down. Ah, oh, it's just, life is just so funny. Okay. Oh, yes, Prabhu.
So we're going to go into the questions. There's a few. We're going to try to cover as much as possible. There's 10 minutes left.
Okay. I just wanted to say that then after that happened, that he did that and left that paraphernalia out in the pot of wine outside, within a few days, I think 3 days, he developed leprosy. Like that, and then the conclusion of that story just is that then he was seeking relief from that and whatever from Lord Chaitanya, and Lord Chaitanya makes an interesting point. Well, I did come to liberate people from difficulties, but nothing specific, no specific difficulty. Mm-hmm. I came to liberate them from the material world, which is just an interesting point for us as devotees. We shouldn't get sucked into a sentimental thinking someone's in a difficult situation, be good to relieve them. The ultimate relief is relieving people from the whole material existence, which we do through the process of Krishna consciousness and, of course, the chanting the Hare Krishna mantra. Just wanted to get that in. Now we'll go through the questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very nice presentation on the pastimes of the Lord and going through the atheistic view, impersonalist Buddhist view, coming to these beautiful pastimes of Srinivas and this 1 year where Lord Chaitanya was in Navadvip before he took sannyas, and this is the way he is eternally performing Sankirtan in the spiritual world. We hope one day we can be blessed to enter into that closed door. So we're going to ask a few questions on impersonalism. Maybe this will help us to be qualified to enter that door. Prayojan Prabhu in the temple room asks, how can you explain that an impersonalist begins to believe in personalism? And I would ask from my side, related to this question, how does the impersonalism in our heart turns into personalism? So it's similar. If you could develop on that, please. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Prabhu. And thank you, Prayojana, Prabhu, for your question. Yes. In an absolute sense, everybody will go back to Godhead. Everyone will go back and serve Krishna. Everyone will go back to take shelter of Krishna's lotus feet. So that just in an absolute sense. But of course, you're asking. I guess you're asking the process. How does one go from being? So as I explained when I was speaking, ultimately everything is the mercy of Krishna and his devotees. And depending on the stage of impersonalism that somebody is absorbed in, you know, it may take literally billions of lifetimes for them to shift from that position to accepting personalism. I think from our point of view, because you're, you know, in one sense, we are the carriers, let's put it another way, we are the best hope for shifting people from that view of impersonalism to personalism. So I would say two things. One thing is, and there's that famous conversation that Prabhupada is having, and now I forgot who he's having it with, but I think it was the French cardinal. Or it may not have been. Anyway, it's a famous conversation, at least in the context of the content of, I can't actually remember the person that the Prabhupada was having.
Daniel Lou,
yeah. That was the French cardinal, but it may not have been him, actually. But anyway, we'll move on. So, at one point in this conversation, Prabhupada got frustrated because people were quoting their Shastra. So if it was Cardinal Danilou, it would have been the Bible. If it was somebody else, it might have been the Quran or whatever it was. And at some point, Prabhupada said, listen, we'll put aside all our scriptures. I won't quote from Bhagavad Gita or anything else, and you don't quote from your scripture. Let's just talk on the basis of logic, reason, and argument. Let's just talk on that basis, at least initially, let's talk on that basis. So that's one thing that's very powerful, is just the principle of logic, reason, and argument. And like I was saying when I was giving that example about the scientists making their presentation to an auditorium, and they say, oh, that's the missing link. By the way, another really important point that you're probably all fully aware of is that the more confidently people speak, regardless of what they're saying, the more confidently they speak, the more people are likely to believe it. So that's another thing, you know. And as devotees, we should be super confident in what we speak, because what we're speaking is coming from, you know, the previous acharya, ultimately from Krishna, previous acharyas, etc., and from Srila Prabhupada. So we should be super confident. We should never, ever, ever present Krishna consciousness with doubt. That really is... among intimate association among devotees, that's a different thing, absolutely. But to the non-devotees, we should always be super confident in how we speak. Super confident, you know. One of the biggest betrayals
both to Srila Prabhupada, but also to being able to help these people. One of the biggest betrayals is if we're doubting when we're speaking or whatever. So we should be really, really confident and present the philosophy on the basis of logic, reason, and argument. And Prabhupada talked so many times, about there being a supreme person. And two simple points. One is everything we see in life, everything that we see, has a designer behind it, has a creator behind it. Nothing ever. I used to live in Belfast when I was in my first few years in devotional service. I spent maybe 3 years in Belfast, and that was when the phrase they used were the Troubles, euphemistically the Troubles. But the Troubles basically were people planting bombs and things blowing up. Have we ever seen anything orderly come from an explosion? Never. It's just chaos. Chaos, rubble, destruction, death. We don't see anything constructive ever coming from big bangs like that. But what we do see after the explosion is architects sitting in an office doing drawings, etc. And they come up with a design, then construction workers go and start building on the basis of that design. So all our experiences are that there is a designer, an organization behind everything. So that's one point. But then the argument is, yes, but can that not be impersonal like that? But then the other point that Prabhupada consistently made was, and again, we should make it with real vigor, who are you to think? Who are you to think that you have something because you've got a personality, just like you're hearing me speak now? Prayojana, you ask the question, if you come on screen and start speaking, you'll have a completely different way of presenting Krishna consciousness than I will have, or at least, a considerably different way of doing it. So we all have personality, yet you have the cheek, you have the audacity to suggest that you've got something, personality, that you say the Supreme does not have. Who the hell do you think you are to make such a point like that? So they were just some basic points that Prabhupada would make. But then the other thing that is key in convincing, shifting people, whether it's impersonalism, whatever it is, that the belief or thought process that they have, the other key thing to shifting them is our own personal practice like that. So it's so important that we reduce every day, really, when we wake up. Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about, beating the mind and all that kind of thing. I think every day when we wake, one of the first things that should come to our mind is, let me be less of a hypocrite today than I was yesterday. And if we do that, have that meditation, and we're gradually, gradually removing all hypocrisy from our life. And as Prabhupada said, a devotee doesn't have a private life. Their private life and their public life are one and the same. The more that we can achieve that, then the more people will be impressed. And once they become impressed, once they see us as an example of what we're speaking, even if they don't necessarily accept what we're saying, once they get into that space of thinking, wow, this person, they really walk the walk, that will have a really big impact then on them hearing the presentation and arguments that we make in relation to personalism and impersonalism.
Thank you so much, Prabhu. It seems like it could go on and on and on and on, and we would continue to hear, but time has come to its end. And the day will go on with the many services and the occupations according to our position in life. Nevertheless, I feel all of us are thankful for this opportunity to hear from you and to imbibe this Prabhupada mood and to carry that to here so that we can carry it to others. I think that's special, and I thank you very much for your time and for this opportunity to hear.
Prabhu, I'm honored to be able to associate with all the devotees there at Bhaktivedanta Manor and presumably beyond now that we have Zoom and the internet. But it's a real honor. I just look forward to the day, whenever that may come, when I'll be able to be in person again.
Soon. We are opening 21st of June, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, unfortunately, they won't let us on an airplane. They have police checks, sort of 500 meters, a kilometer from the airport, and they're stopping every car, and they want to know, what's your reason for traveling? And if you don't have a reason that satisfies them, you get hit with, I think the fine has gone up now to €1,000 or something like that. Anyway, that's another story.
Right.